This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy? Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Jim Kawakami, the editor-in-chief of the very athletic Bay Area. Jim Kawakami.
Tim Kawakami, who's covered the NBA for over two decades, and more specifically the Golden State Warriors over the last 12 years.
This is the TK Show.
Hey everybody, Tim Kawakami here, TK Show, recording from the home studio. Having as my guest, my friend, former employee of mine, and wherever, however that worked. Now the proprietor of the House of Strauss Incorporated Entities conglomeration of media endeavors, the one and only Ethan Strauss. How you doing today, Ethan?
I'm doing really well and just recovering from not just a crazy week of sports news, but a crazy week of sports media news, Tim.
Yes, kind of your kind of groove, right? Right in the middle of the Ethan Strauss House of Strauss sweet spot. We're going to talk about a lot of different things. Warriors for sure. You've written a book about this victory machine that might be kind of on its last electrical charges here. But you got the Pat McAfee ESPN, what Norby Williamson showdown. You've got Bill Belichick leaving the Patriots. You've got Nick Saban. I don't even know. I don't know if you have college football Nick Saban takes, Nick Saban retiring. But I do want to start. You mentioned it, the media stuff going on. You are in on this. The Norby Williamson stuff, I think, is maybe part of the inside. Like, you're hearing little things that maybe some talent does not love Norby Williamson and wasn't so shocked that Pat McAfee would blast him. An unprecedented ESPN, you know, whatever license to ESPN, his Pat McAfee show is on ESPN, blasting an executive at ESPN. You just don't normally hear about that. Ethan, anything you can provide us insight into I know you've written about McAfee, but just kind of the Norby Williamson ESPN side of this?
Well, I think ESPN culturally is a viper pit. So when people get chewed up and spit out of there, they don't talk in the way that Bill Belichick said, "I will always be a Patriot." it's often not exiting on good terms. And Norby Williamson seems to be part of what boxes you out. And it starts with the program or whatever you're doing, not living up to their expectations. And they fire you. They don't find a way to reincorporate you. I remember Jemele Hill and Michael Smith had that show, His and Hers, that did really well for that time slot. And if you could just have some sort of reality where they held on to that show and it did well by those expectations, then they might still be there. But they were graduated to Can You Save SportsCenter? And that's a pretty tall order. And it didn't happen. And the result, at least for Hill, is that, you know, along with whatever happened with those ratings and other things culturally and everything else, but it becomes an ugly divorce. And it isn't just a matter of, oh, let's part ways. And so I think Norby Williamson is part of the ugly divorce story there. And it's a little unclear as to whether he's the fall guy, if he's the convenient bad cop they have there, and sometimes maybe it's really a Jimmy Pitaro decision, but you can kind of make it more of a Norby situation. Bottom line, though, I think in reference to the Pat McAfee situation, divorced from the whole Aaron Rodgers of it all, that's a show that is fascinating to me. It's a situation that's fascinating to me. I understand if somebody is listening right now, maybe you don't even know who Pat McAfee is. Maybe this isn't your interest level. At this point, you probably do. But he had a hit YouTube show. ESPN wants to be in the YouTube business. They want to branch out. They want younger viewers and consumers. And this whole idea was, can we just mash it all together? Can we have YouTube on TV work? And it's not working. And I find that interesting, Tim, just as a media story, because you think it might be. If you're doing a TV show on YouTube, which is effectively what Pat McAfee was doing, you would think that would just work on television. But so far, it seems like nobody knows how to pull that off. And again, compartmentalized from Aaron Rodgers and all of that, their ratings are really bad and the YouTube views aren't that great either. So it's just, it's interesting how medium specific these entities are, is what I'm saying.
You're getting this information from Norby Williamson, Ethan? Is that what's happening? Is he leaking to you too? Are you part of the cabal?
There's literally no other way to find out how well a show is doing other than Norby Williamson telling you. I mean, that's the thing where McAfee was at the very least strongly suggesting that Norby Williamson was talking to New York Post and Andrew Marchand and sabotaging McAfee with these bad numbers. But regardless of whatever Norby is doing, if he is or isn't talking to Andrew Marchand, and I don't know if he is, the numbers are the numbers. The show is not doing well. It is what it is. Maybe it's doing well now, though, Tim. I mean, after all the heat on it because of all this fighting.
Yep.
Yeah, some earned media, as we say.
I that's an interesting point you make. I don't particularly like the Pat McAfee. I mean, I have it on just because I have ESPN on sometimes, and just to make sure, just I'm keeping aware. Nick Saban might retire, right? You might see the headline pop up. I do not find it an entertaining show. I don't particularly find Le Batard that interesting. I'm probably making enemies as we go on here. I kind of like the studio.
You're a Norby.
Yeah.
You're the Norby.
I'm Norby without even knowing it. I like the studio shows. I mean, if I'm going to have something running in the background, I kind of like the studio shows with kind of known content. It's going to be in a package that I understand. I'm an old human being, I'm sure. I don't get it, but it does not surprise me that McAfee isn't doing so well. It does not surprise me that it's not, you know, as good as Wilbon and Kornheiser or some of these other, you know, just establishment shows. I don't know. I just don't think it's an element, I understand, but I don't think ESPN's winning there. I don't know. I mean, maybe ESPN doesn't win in any way, but what would you say? Do they go further in that direction, or do you think they've got to fold it back in and just kind of do what they do?
Well, at the moment we're having this conversation, because people are speculating on all of this, McAfee announced that Rodgers would no longer be on the show this season after he went after Jimmy Kimmel, who is obviously a Disney employee and a highly prized one within that culture. And then this Belichick retirement happens. ESPN says they're going to run SportsCenter, no McAfee during that time. And then today on the McAfee YouTube show that is licensed to ESPN, boom, Aaron Rodgers is back on the show. So I don't see this as sustainable. And I'm not sure McAfee survives the few months after football. Right now, McAfee's kind of a football guy, and it makes sense to have him around. And he's, I think, had some real moments on game day as this Charles Barkley-esque presence. And I think they would love to have him just on game day if they could somehow maybe get away from his show that isn't working. And I agree with you, Tim, by the way. I mean, I'm not trying to be mean to McAfee, but I want a show. I want to feel like you put thought into everything. And I thought it was so interesting to me when McAfee was explaining or doing something of an apology for the initial Rodgers comments on Kimmel. He was saying, in my opinion, why his show doesn't work. He was saying, well, you know, it's, you know, we don't have an A block here. We don't have a B block here. We don't, you know, plan anything. We just sort of show up. And I was thinking when I heard that, it doesn't really work for me. You know, like that could be a good podcast. That could be fine. You and your buddies might have a certain chemistry. It's loosey-goosey. This show was in many ways put on the map. It was doing well before, but it was put on the map by Aaron Rodgers saying anything on it. And I think that's right for YouTube. And that's good for a podcast. If you've got a long drive, you put on some Pat McAfee. I get it. But TV is a different animal, man. And if I'm watching you and it's on ESPN, I just have different expectations. I would far prefer to see Colin Cowherd's show and see something patterned. I know when I tune in, I know that Colin is going to have a monologue about Nick Saban, Bill Belichick, something in that range. And there's an expectation built in versus Pat McAfee where, hey, it's anything can happen. Anything can happen sounds good, but it's not always good.
We're going to do 20 minutes on nothing, right? You know, that's like, there's going to be 20. And I think Lovitard does, again, Dan's a great guy. I don't want to keep ripping him, but I do feel like there's 20 minutes I'm listening to and it's nothing. I am listening to 20. I'm committed to 20 minutes of absolutely nothing. And I don't even get most of it. I love, like, on Pardon the Interruption, one of the greatest things they did was that sideboard of here's the next topics. Here's the 3, 4, 5. Oh, wait a minute. I don't care about this topic, but I sure want to listen to this topic. Very structured. And I've got a mini structure for this podcast with Ethan Strauss. You know, I do believe in some planning, and free form doesn't work on TV. And it may be McAfee showing that to us. Any thoughts there, Ethan?
Yeah, structure brings freedom. This was another controversial episode of a media property, but when Phil Jackson did that long interview with Rick Rubin, there was an excerpted quote at the beginning that hit the news, but it was like a 3-hour interview where he was talking about all sorts of things. And I thought he was making a really good point when he was basically describing how he knifed Doug Collins in the back and took over that operation. And he was so frustrated with Doug Collins because there wasn't a system. And I think when people look to Phil Jackson, they go, what are the secrets of the triangle? How do I do what he did? This team needs to play like this, like that, whatever. And Phil's point, and I'm paraphrasing, is, you know what's more important than the system? It's having a system. It's important to have a system, and then you can play off of it. Then you can establish a rhythm around it. Then you can have a structure that you have some freedom to play within. But you can't just have nothingness. You can't just have give Michael the ball. And I realize that I'm in a glass house when I throw that particular rock. I just run my own site, and it's basically whatever I think is interesting. But these are my observations about what tends to work versus what tends not to work. And I think that a lot of these shows are fun and funny. I think First Things First is a great show, and they're often goofy and they're silly and they break the fourth wall, but that's all within a structure. It's hard to establish some of it without something built in where everybody knows their places and knows where they can explore and knows where they can experiment.
And the viewer understands that. Like Howard Stern, you know there's going to be weird stuff happening, but it's within a context. We don't have to talk. I know people are dying to hear what Ethan Strauss, author of Victory Machine and many other big moments of Warriors history, feels about the Golden State Warriors sitting here, struggling after 37 games. This is a weird moment in time. And you have, I think, some big decisions ahead for them. I think they understand that. What were you thinking in the last two games? We have some of the comments from last night. We can talk about those, especially from Steph Curry. Ethan, is it over? Is this the death throes? Is this salvageable? Where are they headed?
Yeah, in a weird way, the Belichick retirement, it almost reminds me of this situation, just because I don't think we've talked enough about Steve. We talk about Draymond endlessly. You talk about Steve. You write about Steve. But he just, from afar, he just looks exhausted with this situation, not galvanized with it. And it makes me wonder if there's just some sort of shakeup that everybody needs, that everybody needs some sort of fresh start. And this particular situation it's not even about their chances. It's not even about if they could get into the play-in or they could get a seed that is more respectable. It just feels like the story has run out a bit. And I hesitate to say it because I would have felt that way a few years ago after Clay got hurt a few times. Yep. And I know that you're more inclined to preach patience, which makes sense because you can't undo blowing it up. You know, you can't just bring people back like they're Gary Payton the second and bring him back into the situation. But it does look like the story has run out. And then the question becomes, what do you do with 30? Is he going to be like Dirk? Is he satisfied being like Dirk and kind of hanging around while they reformulate whatever this is? Or does he have a demand that I want to chase another title in another place? And I think that becomes the instant focus if a decision is to be made to move off of Draymond or move off of Clay, because the situation just doesn't seem to be able to yield what it once did.
Yeah, I think that's the first premise of everything. You're so correct. You know that. What does Steph want? Can they win with Steph? I think that decision has been made, though, Ethan. I think that's like they are going ahead with Steph, and I think Curry is good with that for now. You know, things change, eras end, things have to be, you know, juggled and maybe seriously changed. But I don't think that's where any, you know, the key stakeholders, and by that I'm saying Joe Lacob, Mike Dunleavy Jr., now the general manager, and Steph Curry are. And if you make that decision, which I think has been made, and I think Curry's comments last night, you know, about, hey, you know, the definition of insanity is if you do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result, meaning the losses, clearly the losses, I think point towards he wants to stay. He thinks they can get this done in some form and realign some things. And he wants Steve Kerr alongside him. That's my read of it. Everything I've heard, again, doesn't mean if this thing falls apart and Kerr has lost them and last two games have not felt like he has them, that's for sure. But it's quick. It's two games. I think if you start with that premise, that Steph Curry is in this, he's with them, he's guiding a lot of things, then I think Steve Kerr comes along. If it all falls apart, everything changes. But I think you're right. That has been the first decision they've made. And I think they've made it. I mean, could you argue to say go away from Steph Curry? Would you say maybe Steph should want to go?
I mean, the second one, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the second one, that's a distinct possibility that Steph Curry says, hey, I don't want to squander the rest of my talent in basketball oblivion. I want to go somewhere. I want to compete. I could see something like that happening. On the other side of it, I don't think you push out Steph Curry. I don't think that he's ever going to be a real net negative to you. Maybe salary wise, you could argue that, but you know, in the next contract, that could be sorted out. But I think when you have a legendary player of his ilk, you try to do it the way they did it with Dirk. You try to have him be one of these rare guys who is in one uniform the entire time. Kobe, if it's possible,
Kobe would be another example.
Kobe would be the other example. And that is a player that people look back on. And it just has a different level of resonance because he was there the whole time. And I think you've got to go for it if you can go for it. Luckily, thankfully, Steph is one of these players who I think can provide value to a team even out of his prime. Reggie Miller was a useful player to the Indiana Pacers as another one of these guys who was in one uniform the entire time. But even after his prime, he was a useful player. So I'm not into the whole trade Steph, see what you can get. I don't even know what you're building with that. But the bigger danger is just Steph's patience. Can he withstand being around while they're trying some things? And they've got to do better with development. And it's hard for me to blame Steve on that one, because I know Steve might not be the most development focused coach, but at the same time, it's not like any of these young guys have gone somewhere and looked better, unless I'm forgetting somebody, Tim. No, I mean, we're not talking.
That's a point that's been made in the locker room to me. Like, it's not like, you know, Eric Paschal went off and was any good anywhere else, or James Wiseman, or whoever else you want to put down the line. Or Smiley Geek.
Patrick, Oh my guy, Smiley Geach. We're not talking about Patrick McCaw's imminent all-star selection. So I think that there have been a lot of draft misses, frankly, and they haven't had great selections at first, but I mean, the margins are thin. The sample size is small, but it's just so unfortunate from a fan perspective of, man, if you somehow hit on that draft, that difficult draft out of COVID where you didn't really know what you were getting with any of these guys, but if you hit on it, if you had gotten, I know Edwards was selected before, but if just things shake out a little different, you have Anthony Edwards, something like that.
Tyrese Halliburton.
Who knows?
Tyrese Halliburton.
Oh, yeah. That was one where the analytics screamed at you to take that guy. But when you watch the film, he wasn't an obvious fit. You know, I remember he really struggled to run pick and roll in college. But yeah, you could have done that. You could have had a hyper analytics pick there and it could have worked out. So it's just that's looking backwards, but looking forwards, they've got to act like they are Oklahoma City right now, because even if they are not Oklahoma City, and even if they are a desired destination, given their contracts and their exhausted assets, they've got to operate as though they need to just moneyball everything and get every single little margin that they can get. And I think they got out of that mode. I think after they acquired the talent, it was all about keeping the talent happy. And they got out of that mode of being hungry in that particular way. They need to figure out how to become a new operation, be the kind of operation that built what they got in 2012, as opposed to the operation that maintained what they had half decade to a decade later.
Well, here's a little thought. Like, if that championship doesn't happen in 2022, they start this process in 2022. Like that July, things start coming off. Maybe it's Draymond. Maybe, you know, they look at some other things from there. And that kind of got them to this point, because if you believe that team could do it, you can believe some other versions of that team. You know, you don't break up, you know, Andrew Wiggins, all these things that they bet on and won with in 2022 are things that they've continued to bet on and now have come up completely. You know, Jordan Poole gets his contract after that season. I can't argue with them. Like, those guys helped you win the championship. Now then you have to be practical and say, okay, it's not working now. And I think what we're seeing and what they're experiencing is that was the run from 22 that took us to this point, and now it's unraveled and we have to figure it out. And I think they've been doing that over the last month. Now, I don't know that they're going to make great moves from here. I don't know. We'll have to see. I think Dunleavy, actually, can you imagine if he didn't have the offseason he didn't draft Pajemski and he didn't draft Trace Jackson Davis, and he did not, you know, acquire Chris Paul. Now, at this point, Chris Paul is not an ad, but he had been the season. I think he's made some practical moves. We'll see where it goes. But if they don't have 2022, this would look a lot different now. And maybe they would be ahead of where they are, but they also wouldn't have that title.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it's this funny thing in sports where you can sometimes be cursed by your own success. Now, in this case, you don't trade it for anything because you won the championship, just an incredibly validating championship after Kevin Durant, with Steph as the main guy, finals MVP. You trade it for nothing. But man, it would have been even worse not to have won it and to feel close and had the same thing happen to him where they don't start the process, be in these sorts of situations where I've heard it argued that maybe the Buffalo Bills would be disadvantaged by winning a few playoff games because McDermott probably isn't the right coach, but then it would feel like maybe he is. So you don't make the decision that you should, obviously make. So yeah, Dunleavy, I think to what you're saying, has made some solid moves. Maybe they're having draft success. I don't want to hop on that these guys are obviously draft successes because we've just seen it happen so much, Tim, of a guy has a little bit of a spark and you go, oh my God, you know, look at this guy, look what he could do. And then it just has not, we've so rarely seen these guys really come to fruition and be quality contributors as opposed to a flash in the pan.
Yeah, I just say, I think we've talked about this. If a rookie is productive right away, it's a very good sign. And if he's not productive right away, doesn't mean he's a bust, but it means maybe this isn't going to happen all the way through. And even with Kuminga, who we've all seen exciting things from, and we all think, you know, well, many of us, I don't know, I've been asked you, I don't want to speak for you, but, you know, can play in this league and probably is going to have a nice career. But it's like it comes and goes, still year three. You know, you don't know for sure what you're getting from him in year three. Hard to say. I want to ask you, you write about, I think you write about NBA TV ratings. I mean, you might have written about that a time or two. And I enjoy what you write about NBA TV ratings. You make me think. When I was your editor, I really thought these were valuable pieces. And you've continued to write them on your Substack, which is great. But now you got Durant, not, you know, at towards the end. You've got LeBron at 39. You've got Steph, who is on this team that's struggling. They're going into a new TV contract. Does this affect what they can get on a TV contract, you think? And where can the league put out? Is Giannis can carry it? Can Luka Doncic carry? Can you know, Jokic carry it? Or do they need some other wave behind them to generate the way we've thought about the league, which has been at the, you know, the forefront of at least of a lot of discourse, maybe not ratings, but certainly out front? Could this be the end of a certain kind of era for the NBA?
It's a great question. And in a way, it almost mirrors what the Warriors are going through and what the Lakers are going through. Just as they're trying to mine the last years, the last productive years of these incandescent superstars, so too is the league. And I don't think, I mean, it's rather amazing the degree of difference in terms of interest in the games that Steph Curry and LeBron play in versus the other teams. It's not like that in the other sports. You don't see a, I don't know, Chiefs Cowboys game on a Sunday get twice what some other matchup would get. The NBA is like that. And that is a huge difference, that these individual personalities swing just so much interest of this multi-billion dollar company. And I'm not sure they can really replace it. I mean, this is a big question. I'm not sure, Tim, that we can create fame the same way that we used to. This Taylor Swift concert was such a phenomenon, I think, in part because she's almost like the youngest truly famous person. She experienced fame before social media reached critical mass, which is true of Steph Curry and true of LeBron James. Steph with his Davidson run, LeBron, I mean, we've known about him since the first Bush administration. He's been around forever. So I'm not sure in this fractured culture we live in where ESPN is terrified of losing Pat McAfee and his 200,000 YouTube views or whatever, if these incoming guys, this incoming cohort can be as famous and command that interest. I think some of it too is that the league is internationalized, which is really good for creating fan bases overseas, but there's less of a connection. I mean, people get uncomfortable talking about this stuff, but it's just true that people tend to have more of a connection to, you know, their own countrymen than, you know, guys like Jokic has started to sort of communicate, but he kind of doesn't. And he's sort of in an orbit we don't understand as much. And to a certain extent, same with Luka. So I think that's a huge challenge. Now, does it impact what they get from these rights holders? If they're smart, this is something that the broadcasters are going to be thinking about when they negotiate. I think the league perspective just gets very short term. They are just desperate to get this deal done, and they're desperate to just get the ink dry on the paper And you see that in some of the decisions. They had a nationally televised Wemby game. I think it was Hornets Spurs, and they flexed that the hell out of here. It's just no. Like, we are not investing right now in building up the next. We need to mine what we have. We need to get what we can get out of the guys who are established. And then after we sign the deal, figure out how the hell to build the next 10 years of interest in the NBA.
You're someone who knew David Stern pretty well, and I think you've followed Silver. I don't think you know Adam Silver that well. How do you think Silver is doing? What kind of commissioner is he?
I think he's more of a go-along, get-along type, which informed why Stern left. When Stern left, it was a little similar, again, to the Belichick split from the Patriots, where, yes, it was voluntary, kind of. It was mutual, kind of. But there were some people trying to push him out. And the new owners at that time, they didn't like how much of a dictator David Stern was. And they wanted somebody who was a bit more of an employee in Adam Silver. Now, what's so strange with Silver is that he's become that way with the players. And he seems to view things through the prism of what the players want. And look, if I'm making a defense of him, he's had labor peace, right? He hasn't had strikes and lockouts and these acrimonious feuds. It's just been, hey, I'll give you what you want. I'll give what you want. But I think it's been a real absence of leadership. I think that he's failed the league in that capacity. I don't think it's right when you've got a Ben Simmons situation and the guy's not showing up for work and the Sixers are punishing Ben Simmons at that time. For that, and the league is in their corner and they're saying, do whatever you want to Ben Simmons, but they're making the Sixers be the bad guy. I don't think that's right. I don't think that would happen under Stern. I think that's a situation where the commissioner has to have a loud voice and has to say, you signed a contract, you have to show up to work. This is absurd. We can't have a situation where we've got to drag you into training camp and you're obviously going through the motions. And we're gonna find ways. I mean, I don't know what the bylaws are, but Stern would find ways to make transgressors uncomfortable. And he was feared. And that gave, again, this is the structure brings freedom. There was a structure to the NBA. The NBA right now, Tim, feels a little bit too much like the Pat McAfee show. And I think Adam Silver has some blame there.
Did Stern want Silver to be a successor? Did he kind of pick him, or was that out of his hands at that point?
I think Silver was groomed to be Stern's successor, and to hear them tell it, Stern was in his ear during the David Sterling saga and helping him.
Donald Sterling.
Donald Sterling. Not Roger Sterling from Mad Men, but Donald Sterling. I mean, I'm sure that guy would have had a workplace issue or two if he were a... But that's neither here nor there. I think that he was a little bit forced out, Stern was, but Silver was also his guy. And we all know about the Peter principle of maybe people are really optimized to be one thing and then they get hired to be the next thing. I think it's quite possible that Silver was a great right-hand man to David Stern and not somebody I would assess as a great commissioner, but a lot of the media disagrees. I mean, a lot of the media, sports media, says that Silver is a great commissioner. I would argue that that's a bad sign. I think a commissioner is somebody the media hates. I think that's a good commissioner. If the media likes you, then I don't think you're serving your function as being the bad cop, as being everything is everything right now, Tim, as being the Norby Williamson of your league. You got to be the Norby of your league to be a commissioner.
Somebody put it this way a little while ago about Silver is, the Donald Sterling situation and all the plaudits he got for that, the universal praise, which was right at the beginning of his tenure, kind of ruined him because he just wants applause now. Like everything, you can almost hear him, like he wants to be, oh my God, you're the greatest ever. That decision you made was just like the Donald Sterling one. You are righteous. You're the guy. And however much I applauded the Donald Sterling decision, and I don't think I can pick seven things that I would argue with Adam Silver. It just feels like he plays to the reaction. I've said this about some NFL coaches, Brandon Staley of the Chargers. It felt like he played to the social media reaction. And you can do that. I think there's some people who have success doing that. I think mostly in sports, you're going to fall into some traps when you do that. You have to have something you believe in and something you're going to do, and you're just going to do it. And if people in the moment don't like it, maybe at the end of it, they'll see the wisdom of it. And I think that was Stern. And again, I didn't love everything. Stern yelled at me a few times, but I see the kind of the hardiness of that, right? The traction, like this is going somewhere, not, oh, wait a minute, we better stop and we better make this statement because somebody is on ESPN ripped us. And I do feel that a little bit about Silver, and it's definitely ESPN. He is so reactive to ESPN. We know that's where he shows up for interviews. We know if ESPN's talking about it, there's going to be a press release. There's going to be a statement. Draymond Green does something. Now, deserved all punishment, whatever. He's accepted it. But, you know, I know if ESPN is talking about something that he did the previous night, he's going to get suspended for it. I feel that a lot with Adam Silver. I would think you would agree with that.
I would completely agree with that. I completely agree with what you said, that this initial blast of praise he got at the beginning ultimately shaped him, and maybe to his detriment, because how could it not? I think it's easy from the outside to not understand what going through something like that is like. Adam Silver was not a very public person or a known quantity before banning Donald Sterling for life, and then it's like his name and fame 100x'd, and it was praise and just, I mean, that is going to influence how you see things and how you act. But I think the issue is he may have learned the wrong lesson from it. I think the lesson he learned from it was, I should do what the players want. When in reality, one of the reasons why that decision was so popular and applauded is because it was strong leadership. And it was somebody saying, we're not going to have this chaos of an owner acting completely outside the boundaries of anything approaching decency. I'm here. I'm providing a structure. It stops. That is something that goes over really well. And he, I think, instead learned, I should just do what the players want, what the athletes want. That leads to a certain structurelessness. And that's ultimately what happened. And I totally agree with what you said about the sensitivity. I think it's interesting to contrast Silver too with Goodell, because they almost had opposite experiences, where Goodell was getting grilled around that era and he was getting humiliated and attacked and he was the bad commissioner. I wonder if that helped Goodell, that it was such a searingly painful public experience for him that maybe it forced him to care less about what is said about him, whereas Silver is now always addicted to it and chasing it.
Not bad. We are way too long. We're more than 30 minutes into this without bringing up. I lured you on to talk 49ers because I know you are
the yes.
49er expert, quarterback expert, really, right? NFL quarterback expert that lives on these social media streets. 49ers get the bye week right now. They're going through it. Who do you think they least want to play? As a 49er, I don't know if you're a 49er fan, but as a 49er close observer, who do you think they would least like to play, and how do you think they shape up for a Super Bowl run here?
Yeah, not only am I the number one football writer, the foremost football writer in America, Tim, I am the number one 49ers fan. So let's just let it be known.
Chalk it up. Let's just let reality be reality.
I mean, it's so obvious that the team they would least want to play would be the Ravens. But then it's a funny thing, because if they're playing the Ravens, then, hey, season well done. You're in the Super Bowl. So congratulations.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, whatever happens, happens. But the Ravens thing, I mean, I feel like their defense is not talked about enough. Statistically, all those measures, DVOA, I mean, they're insane. And their D coordinator, McDonald, is regarded as this genius, this boy wonder. And I mean, look, I mean, you saw the results Christmas night. Now, you know, the ray of hope, if you really fear them from a Niners perspective, is that Lamar Jackson has been one of these guys who doesn't do as well against the AFC, and in the playoffs has struggled. So I think as a Niner fan, obviously, principally, you're rooting for the Niners to win the NFC playoff games, but you should also probably be rooting against whoever the Ravens' opponent is whenever they play somebody. It's hard to answer the question of who to fear in the NFC. I mean, you don't want to look at it overconfidently from their perspective, because the playoffs are hard. But these NFC teams just seem shaky. And I really do think the Rams, I mean, we don't have a big track record because it almost seems like they got good late in the season. But they do seem like the scariest team. Or am I crazy, Tim?
I think the 49ers agree with you. I mean, I think the 49ers expect to see them, and that's the team they probably would least like to see. You're not a bunch of superpowers in the NFC, but I think that is the team. That, you know what, that Matthew Stafford, and you put Puka Nacua and Cooper Kupp and Aaron Donald, like those are things you have to deal with, and the 49ers have dealt with it. Yeah. They won 9 straight regular season games over them before the last game of loss, which was really didn't matter. They did lose in the NFC Championship game. I just think if you just had it, give me a list of players you don't want to see and coaches, the Rams would like have the first four names: McVay, Stafford, Donald, Cooper Kupp. Like bing, 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 bing. And then everyone else is after that. I don't think the 49ers fear them, but I think that's the one they go, yeah, we wouldn't mind not playing that team. And here they are, if that's what happens.
Yeah. I mean, I just have flashbacks to how easily, before the wheels fell off of Joe Burrow, how easily the Bengals were just moving the ball up and down the field. And you think about those two talented receivers. And I mean, that's a team where they're just a lot scarier than their record. I mean, I think from a Niners perspective, you're probably rooting for anybody else to be the lower seed, who they face coming out of this first week. From a drama perspective, from a Joe football fan perspective, I think that's the game you want to see. I think it would be very exciting to see that first playoff game the Niners have against the Rams. But yeah, they're the scariest team. The other ones don't scare me as much. The Eagles,
you were on that Eagle decline trade. You called that one.
Well, I did something. I cheated a little bit. Steve Young said something, and I thought, "Huh. Well, at least if I'm wrong here, I'm as wrong as Steve Young is. That's not bad. That's not a bad currency to peg myself to." But I think he saw it early, and it's funny the way takes go and the way you try to portray savviness in the media. At the moment I said that the Eagles were effectively cooked, they were coming off that Niners loss, and the smart take in NFL media was, don't overreact to this. They've got an easy schedule. The Niners are just a juggernaut. You know, everyone's going to overreact because we're used to people overreacting. And I think what Steve Young did, it was just, he was very observational about it in showing, A, just the linebacking was just this issue that you cannot fix. You can't get over that. And the Niners just killed them in the flats, just killed them with short passes. Yeah, they've completely fallen apart. Dallas is a weird one. I mean, who knows what to really think about the Cowboys? I mean, the Niners have had their way with them. I think I would be confident from a Niners perspective if that was the matchup. It seems like some of the scarier teams for the Niners are in the AFC, which is not a bad deal at all.
All right, Brock Purdy, we've talked about this on your podcast. I know you are intrigued by the discourse, by where he ranks, how, you know, and now it becomes important, not the discourse, to hell with that part, but can he be a winning playoff quarterback? He's won two playoff games, by the way, which is one more than Lamar Jackson in his career, which is something I've noted. I don't know how much it means, but it's something. But you get in a shootout, as Kyle Shanahan has said, you don't want to go up against that great quarterback because you just don't know what he can pull out of his pocket. Patrick Mahomes against them in the Super Bowl, Stafford against them in the NFC Championship game. We can go on Tom Brady on against the Atlanta Falcons that Shanahan was offensive coordinator for in that Super Bowl. Purdy, one of those guys. Does it matter to you whether we decide he's one of those guys? How have you viewed the whole Purdy discourse so far?
I think he can be one of those guys. I think he's got to prove it, obviously, but I'm less pessimistic than some about this whole idea of can't play from behind. I've seen some bad quarterbacks lead fourth quarter comebacks, and I think it's mostly a function of sample size. I think it is real that Kyle Shanahan is maybe a very buttoned up coach, and sometimes when you're not on a schedule, not on a script, it's harder. I think that's real. And I think that's going to be in the back of people's minds until we see it, until it's demonstrated. But I don't think there's just something that is preventing that from happening. And, you know, a lot of these Brock Purdy picks, yeah, he had the two, you could say the concussion in that Vikings game. But a lot of the other picks come in situations that are not desperate, fighting from behind. I know there's probably a method to the madness with Shanahan having a juice check out there as a receiver, but I have noticed on a few occasions a Brock Purdy pick will happen and juice is in running a route that the defense doesn't seem to care about and there aren't open guys. So I think those situations might be one that I would highlight as one that worries me, but I think he's a good quarterback, Brock Purdy is. I would say top 10. I said top 10 early. He's got a shot to really prove that he's a lot more than that. And it is funny, you mentioned the two playoff victories. It's like they didn't even happen to a lot of people who analyze the league. It's just crazy the way he's assessed. The idea that a rookie quarterback goes in there and wins two playoff games and it's just shrug it off. Every time he has a bad game, we have to say that he turned into a pumpkin. I just think the way he's assessed is just completely crazy to me. He's a good player. And, you know, ultimately, if he fails, the discourse will be unfair to him. But that's part of what makes sports exciting. It's that sense of stakes. If you're a Brock Purdy fan, that suspense that you know he's going to get crushed unless he comes through. So pressure's on. He's got to come through.
My kind of vague way of doing this is he's got to be like at least as good as Josh Allen. Like that's probably the third best, you know, kind of playoff quarterback at this moment. And he hadn't been great in the playoffs, but he's put numbers. You got Mahomes one in a limited situation. The Chiefs just don't have receivers anymore, but still Mahomes. I would say, God, I'm lost now. Lamar two, just for pure talent. And you got Josh Allen, Matthew Stafford 3-4, but I put Purdy in that group. You got to be in that group. You can't be, you know, determinedly behind those guys. If you can get into a game and you're as good as Josh Allen or you're as good as Matthew Stafford, I think the 49ers, all other things are superior to most other teams and they'll be fine. It's if Jimmy Garoppolo was a lot worse than Pat Mahomes, and that's what happened, and we showed up in the fourth quarter. Can you be just a step behind Mahomes? Can you be right there with Josh Allen? Can you be sort of right there with Lamar Jackson? Then I think the 49ers can win the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. And it is funny, again, the margin's so slim, the sample size so small. If Tart catches that interception that Stafford threw to him, then how is he regarded? What are our expectations when it comes to that guy? Who seems to be of such a higher status than Goff, for instance. He's got to come through. He's got to prove it. I think he's good. I think he can do it. I don't have the kinds of doubts that other people in media might have about him, but it's a small sample size game. There's a lot of pressure, and I'm excited to see it. I this might be the football playoffs I'm most excited for in all my memory of watching a football season.
In all your quarterback analysis and all those years you've studied the film, I am awed at that statement. I'm going to ask you, to close this, I'm going to ask you a version of a question I've asked you before. I've asked all my guests. I haven't even previewed this with you. Sometimes I do. I'm just going to throw out a topic for you. Ethan Strauss, what's your favorite TV show right now?
Oh, my God. Well, I think White Lotus, which isn't – I mean, they're coming back for a third season. I think White Lotus is my favorite right now, and I don't think it's close. I like how they refresh every season in a new location. I think so many TV shows are done by committee, and that can be good. Collaboration can be good, but it can undermine art. I like that Michael White, who makes those White Lotus shows and writes everything, that he is an auteur. And that he's odd and he has a distinct perspective. And I know that whatever's happening there is just not diluted by any sort of other noise. And it's sharp. It's just sharply observed. I think this guy goes on a lot of vacations, a lot of rich guy vacations, and watches this cohort of people. And I thought the first season's pretty good. I thought the last season was the best television post pandemic, and I would put it above Succession, which I like a lot, but Succession's not coming back. And yeah, so I bet you're a Succession guy, though.
If I, had I was guess. In on That's it. I wasn't. Assumption. I didn't love it. I watched it and I respected it. I get to be a little bit of sucker for who's the good guy here. I get a little bit of like, I'm not sure who am I cheering. Not, you know, not trumpets blaring and, you know, sword play and all that stuff. Although I don't mind that stuff, but like, who's the sympathetic character? I don't, you know, was it supposed to be Kendall? Shiv? No. Really wasn't. I mean, I obviously loved it when, you know, Logan, whenever he was on screen, but at some point it kind of gets to me. Like, I thought, even, you know, I love Mad Men, but I thought the end of Mad Men, like, who's happy here? Who am I liking? Mm. Sopranos was the same thing. I think sometimes these creators, they don't run out of story, but they kind of run out of love for their characters. And it's more, they lean on the kind of the angrier, aggressive side. And I lose the feeling that they love this stuff. You know, I wasn't a huge Succession guy ever. I just, other than the dialogue was brilliant, I wanted a little bit of a rooting interest into where it was going. At some point, I'll go back and rediscover it, but never felt that. I'm the Bear. I'm watching The Bear now. Mike Dunleavy recommendation, and really liking it. I'm really liking the acting. And more, I mean, I'm surprised how much I like the acting in it. The acting is so subtle. You know me, I don't love the look at me acting. I don't love look at me anything. I don't like, you know, please love me. And it is not that. It is really, you know, flat, you know, emotionally, but it's broader than that. If you feel it deeper when they're not just trying to be appealing to you, and you do, you have sympathies for, and that's the interesting thing. And I'm just thinking it through. You have sympathies for every single character. Like, there's some stupid characters, but you still feel something for them. You're feeling their arc. Maybe that's a little different than Succession. I just, as you pointed out.
Yeah. More heart.
Yeah.
There's more heart on The Bear. And I don't know the actor's name, but whoever plays Richie, that is an amazingly well-acted character. That is a real guy. That is a guy that exists in real life. That does not feel like a TV character. That feels like a person, a flawed person, a person, if you watch the show, you're going to hate sometimes, but ultimately you feel something about that character. I think you're exactly right. The Bear is a warmer show, and it's easy to be treacly, maybe overly sentimental and look goofy when your show has heart like that. But the acting performances, I think that's what allows it to still feel real and still feel authentic and quality, even when it does have that heart. So yes, The Bear is another show that I quite enjoy. I'm a little worried about it. I don't know. I worry they're going to fall off in season 3, and I don't know if that is informed by anything real. But my own paranoia. I just wonder, I hope that they're not being like Adam Silver and reading everything written about them now that they're internet darlings. I hope they stick to their mission.
That's why season 2 was so good, right? It was like made quickly after season 1, and you're not reading the reviews. They're just putting out a show. And I told Richie was the character I was referring to when I said that. And you jumped right on it. It's like, I hate that guy sometimes. But again, I understand the inner drive. I understand who he is. And it explains a lot of things to me. And the character is so fleshed out. The acting is so, that's why I said the acting is so good. The Sydney, the woman who plays Sydney, is so good that you're kind of living with them. You're not waiting for the punchline. You're not waiting for the next dramatic speech. You're just living with them. And I think that's what that show does brilliantly, more than any show that I watched recently. Again, Mike Dunleavy, Mr. Chicago. He spent those years in Chicago, so he was recommending it for me as somebody who kind of knows that scene. All right, Ethan, we've gone long enough. We could go on and on and on. I do appreciate it, as always. Read the Substack. Watch him do all his podcasts. You do a lot of podcasts, man. You record a lot of podcasts. Good, which is good. Content, baby, content. Yeah. Thank you so much. Miss editing you, Ethan. I'm sure you miss me editing you. It certainly was the highlight of your career, but all good.
I do. You were a great editor. I mean, I'm not even joking. I could have gone for a joke or a little jab right there, but no, I miss it as well, Tim. And thank you so much. These conversations are always great.
All right, everybody. That's the show for today. Thanks, Ethan.